HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 91, recorded live Monday, December 3rd, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott discusses Eclipse with Bjorn Freeman Benson.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I am privileged to be sitting down here with Bjorn Freeman Benson, the Director of Committer Community at the Eclipse Foundation. Thank you, sir, for taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Yeah, no problem.
So most people who listen to this podcast are Microsoft developers, although our audience is starting to expand a little bit. And they know that Eclipse is a thing that's out there. But for the most part, they may not have necessarily experienced it in their everyday life. But Eclipse is a huge part of a great deal of developers' lives from day to day. What should a Microsoft developer know about Eclipse?
Well, yeah, it's sort of a large question.
It's a big question.
Eclipse is probably the most popular. I think we actually have stats somewhere that demonstrate that it is the most popular Java IDE. Now, Eclipse has expanded to be more than just a Java IDE, but it's best known for being a Java IDE. So since a lot of Microsoft developers work in C# and that sort of thing, they don't work in Java. They don't have that familiarity with Eclipse. Whereas people who build Java applications, web servers, clients, rich clients, and so on, all know about Eclipse, even if they don't use it, even if they use one of the other tools out there. As a developer, you might consider Eclipse to be sort of the Java version of Visual Studio. Visual Studio is the 800-pound gorilla. It's the main development environment that you use if you're a Windows programmer, even if you happen to use one of the other tools that are out there. There's a wide variety of them. Everybody knows about Visual Studio. Same thing applies in the Java world. Even if you use one of the other Java tools, you know about Eclipse as, you know, it's the main programming environment.
And where did it come from originally? Is there a Linus for Eclipse who is like the guy who made it and then it became a foundation? Or how did it...
So the history of Eclipse started at this little company, Object Technology International, or known as OTI, in Ottawa. And I worked for them for a while, and we made Smalltalk programming environments, basically. And we made a deal with IBM, even when we were an independent company, and they sold it as IBM Smalltalk, which was known as Visual Age Smalltalk at the time. And that same group, after being bought by IBM, went on to produce the first IBM Java programming environment, which was called Visual Age for Java, which was innovative but fairly weak in its execution. It had a number of flaws. And then they went on to make a new version of that, which became Eclipse. Then IBM decided to take that proprietary code that they had in that, and they were actually selling that for multiple thousands of dollars and so on, and open source that for a number of reasons. But that became the open source Eclipse product that's out there. And then after a few years of that being just open under IBM's label, they decided to spin it out to a separate foundation, which is where I work today, which is a non-IBM thing. It's funded by the member companies of the Eclipse Foundation, of which there are currently 120 member companies, or maybe 130. I'm never quite sure exactly what the number is. And they all put in varying amounts of money to help run the foundation, maintain the servers, provide the bandwidth, you know, pay the salary of myself and the few other employees there are of the foundation, et cetera.
So a foundation like this, an open source foundation, isn't a behemoth. It's not a huge thing. I mean, I'm sitting here in your offices in downtown Portland, Oregon, and, you know, with all due respect, I was surprised that it was so small. Somehow I assumed it would be mahogany walls and big desks, and it's just you and another gentleman right now.
Yeah, there are actually four of us here in Portland, and then there's another, I think, eight or nine in Ottawa. We live in the locations we live in because we like living there. I lived in Ottawa for a while and decided it was a bit cold, so I prefer Portland. There are people who like living there for family reasons or whatever. But the foundation itself doesn't do the work. It's not like Microsoft building Visual Studio, where Microsoft builds all of the code and there are, gosh, I don't even know how many people there are working on the Visual Studio product, but I'm sure it's in at least the hundreds, if not a thousand, right? The work of writing the code for Eclipse is done by people out there who typically work for our member companies. And there are 800 to 900 of those committers out there who work on Eclipse, either part-time or full-time.
Wow.
And so those are the people who are the committers on the project who have the right access. There are more people than that who contribute patches and code and so on, but I don't have a count for those. So the, you know, the 12 or so employees of the foundation do things like system administration, keeping the servers up, making sure that elections are run fairly and things like that. Carl, who's sitting over there to my right, is one of our system administrators and is busy fixing a problem with, I think, the website at this very moment.
Wow.
But he and I don't actually write the code. Those are done by the 800 or 900 developers who are out there.
And is there, of those 800 or 900, are there leads? I mean, how is that structured? Is there a hierarchy?
There's a hierarchy, but it's a meritocratic hierarchy. So we've currently divided up into, I think, 80 different sub-projects around the entire Eclipse philosophy. I could go over to the web browser and look it up. We have a page that lists them all. But for instance, there's a sub-project that deals with Java tooling, and there's a sub-project that deals with C tooling, and sub-project that deals with UML diagramming, and so on. And each one of those is run by between 2 and 20 people. And those 2 and 20 people self-select a leader among them that they want to follow. So each one of those projects has a project lead, or sometimes co-leads, who sort of define where the project's going to go and what things are going to be worked on, how to triage the bugs and that sort of thing. But it's all done by, you know, if you and I are sitting together working on some project and we decide that you're better to lead the project, we go, okay, now you're the leader and off you go. And then, you know, maybe later you get tired of doing that. And this has happened at Eclipse. You know, you've got other things to do in your life. And so then I become the leader for a while because everybody says, well, you know, you're the guy who knows the architecture. You go off and do it.
And for the most part, these are people who are using Eclipse and they're fixing Eclipse. I mean, they're using it in their everyday life. Their job may not necessarily be full time to be a committer on Eclipse or.
Yeah. Everybody who's using the, or who's working on the Eclipse environment is also using the Eclipse environment. I think it would be really hard to be a developer on Eclipse if you weren't using it in everyday life. I suppose it's possible, but.
And are they full time? I mean, these member companies, so I mean, if I assume a member company becomes a member company because they have some deep investment in Eclipse. They're using it or they feel they're not just doing it out of, to be philanthropic.
Well, it could be. I haven't actually spoken with them and asked each one of them, why are you doing this? Although I have to believe that most of them are doing it because they have some corporate market-based reason for doing that. It wouldn't make a lot of sense for that many companies to just go out and donate time for no particular reason. So I'm positive, you know, my belief without having done any interviews that they're all doing that for some corporate reason, trying to make money. One of the interesting things about Eclipse as an open source foundation versus other open source foundations is that we're an explicitly commercial open source group. Our goal is for all of our member companies to be able to make money with the open source that's out there. Our goal isn't necessarily to give away free software, although there's sort of a, I was going to say a vicious cycle, but it's not really vicious, a reinforcing cycle of, you know, if we have enough users who are using the free stuff, that provides a market which enables the companies to sell additional products on top of that market or services or something. But we're definitely aiming at, our goal is for companies to make money on top of the things that are out there.
So let's say that I, and forgive me of my ignorance here because I'm trying to get my head around this. Let's say that I want to start a company around this new LOL code that I just that've been released. This is the funny cats that speak funny languages, and I've developed this new language, and we have no IDE though. All the LOL code is being written in Notepad. I could take Eclipse and extend it, add plugins, add understanding of this environment.
Right. So you would want to add the plugins that would make an IDE for LOL code. And in fact, we have a new project at Eclipse that helps you do that. You basically define the syntax and the semantics of the language, and it generates an IDE for you around whatever language you've typed in.
Wow.
Now, you know, obviously the IDEs is not as polished as, say, you might find in Visual Studio, where you've had hundreds of people working on all the little details, but it whips out the basic structure for you in fairly quick order. So then you can make your LOL code IDE on top of Eclipse.
And does it say Eclipse or does it say Scott's LOL code IDE? I mean, how much, you know, I can brand this really. I mean, then I can go and sell it.
you can brand it as much as you want. And some people do. We found that generally in the embedded space, companies tend to build a branded IDE on top of Eclipse that you know is Eclipse if you're good at it, because you sort of look at it, you go, oh, that looks like Eclipse Windows, but it doesn't say Eclipse anywhere. And that in the server side space, people tend to build on top of Eclipse and then add extensions to that. So it says Eclipse, but then with their extensions on top of that.
Probably because I think in the server space, the name Eclipse holds some weight and some sense of quality, and we're getting something that we can count on. So they feel, the developer who's consuming that end product feels comfort in that this is built on Eclipse.
Yeah, that could be. The other thing we found is that companies, when they first move to using Eclipse as an open source platform, feel that they need to put a brand around the whole thing. So they work very hard to make it their own thing, just happens to be built on top of Eclipse. And then relatively quickly, their customers say, oh, I see it's built on top of Eclipse. I'd like to use this other tool, which is also built on top of Eclipse, in combination with your tool. And the first company goes, well, we didn't anticipate that, so there's not really a way to do that. And then their customers drive them into being more open and allowing the customers to combine different tools from different vendors. And that turns out to be a great attraction for the customers. And then they try and buy more tools that are based on Eclipse because they have this ability to combine them.
So is there a distinct difference between the auto generation of the branded IDE on the one side and the extending Eclipse proper through extensions?
Well, what it ends up being is, do you have an installer and that creates an EXE that you double click to start it up? Mm-hmm. Or do you take an existing Eclipse image and install plugins into that? That's sort of the difference.
I see. And what are the licensing requirements? If I was going to go and make my LOL code Eclipse IDE, do I have to pay you? Who do I pay?
So all of the Eclipse code is licensed. All of the Eclipse open source code is licensed under the Eclipse public license, which is one of these licenses which requires that if you modify the code, you distribute the modified code, but it's not viral in the GPL sense where it doesn't attach itself to all the rest of your code. So this means that you can write commercially licensed plugins and ship them with Eclipse, and that your commercially licensed plugins don't become polluted by the EPL.
I see. Right? But if I had to modify Eclipse to do it?
Right. If you modify the base Eclipse code, the EPL says that you then have to release that base Eclipse modifications out to the world to help the rest of the world.
But I wouldn't have to ship the source code to my extensions.
Absolutely not.
So one of the things that I thought would be of interest to some of the Microsoft developers that are listening is this really amazing IDE based on Eclipse called Aptana that is a JavaScript IDE. And I didn't know it was Eclipse until I noticed some of the windows and the buttons. And I said, wow, that really looks like Eclipse. Went into the preferences and noticed that it was built as an add-on. Now, they've built both a community edition and a pro edition. Is that a real common way for a commercial company to still have a foot in open source by offering a free version and then by offering a commercially licensed version, all based on Eclipse?
Well, I think it is. And I actually think that when you go that route, you go back to when we were building tools, 10, 15 years ago, even Visual Studio had a personal edition, a professional edition, and a enterprise edition, I think what they were called. And the personal one was low cost, and the professional one was more cost, and so on. And now, with this open source model that Aptana is using and various other people are using, the personal edition has become free, right? And then you have these more expensive editions. I mean, IBM still sells a version of Eclipse called Rational Application Developer. You know, it's Eclipse with a whole bunch more tools built on top of it, which, so you can get Eclipse, which IBM is distributed, you know, now through the foundation. It's no longer an IBM thing. Mm-hmm. Or you can buy Rational Application Developer, which is this full featured, suite of tools for doing enterprise size development.
And all these are written in Java, all these plugins. That's the primary plugin architecture for Eclipse, is to write jar files and write Java extensions?
Yes. Currently, you have to write all your extensions in Java. I wish it were different. I wish you could write your extensions in any programming language, but we have yet to actually see that technology take over. And there are certain there are certain technical reasons why that turns out to be difficult, which if you have plenty of time in your podcast, we can go into, or if you have another podcast, we could go into. But I think it would be great, for instance, if I could be able to write extensions in, say, JavaScript or PHP, which I happen to be doing a lot of.
Yeah.
Or if I'm a C-sharp programmer, if I were to write my extensions in C-sharp and have them work on Eclipse, right? Because there are people out there who want to use Eclipse who don't have necessarily a lot of Java experience. The Aptana example is great. Those people are really sharp people. They have a great community built around that product. But a lot of those people are either Ruby programmers, because Aptana also does Ruby,
right,
or JavaScript programmers, neither of which translates directly to being a Java programmer. So it'd be great if those people could write extensions to Eclipse in their own language. But we don't have that technology yet.
Yeah. It seems like it would be good if there was some kind of a, and I'm thinking of the Firefox kind of Zool XUL method of extension, where there's a manifest of some kind, an XML manifest that then in the system will handle the instantiation of whatever those objects in the bridging, such that one could build an abstraction layer that was generic across all IDEs, so that one could build a plugin that would work in both Visual Studio and in Eclipse and in whatever. But perhaps that's a view of a utopian future that it'll never...
Well, I have that same utopian view, so I'm glad to hear you express that. Because I think there's a lot of things that IDEs do that are common across all the IDEs that it would be handy if we didn't have to reinvent them over and over again. And one of the reasons Eclipse exists in the first place is because a lot of the vendors in the Java IDE space looked around and said, hey, we're building the same tools for connecting to, say, CVS, and you're building the same tools, and this other guy's building the same tools. Why don't we get together and just build them once, and then we can spend our energies building the quality, product quality things on top of it rather than reinventing the same base stuff over and over again. And I think that as IDEs get more sophisticated and Visual Studio gets more sophisticated and Eclipse tries to keep up or wherever you want to make that dividing line, there are a larger and larger base of those things that we could do in common between not just Visual Studio and Eclipse, but Eclipse and some of the other, you know, there's IntelliJ, which is another popular Java environment, which has a lot of great stuff in it. Mm-hmm. But they must also do a lot of the same basic things and have plugins, right?
It's really interesting to watch the community kind of self-correct, because I feel like on one really far side of the extreme view are the people who believe that everything should be open sourced and that, you know, free software completely. And then, of course, on the other side is that everything should be commercial. But somewhere in the middle, the community decides where the current water level is and where things below that water level should be free. And there's just kind of an expectation of free that is kind of in the ether. You can't quite get your finger on it, but the community ultimately decides that, you know, I think syntax highlighting IntelliSense editors, I think we can all agree, are something that we shouldn't have to pay for or much for. And there should be value added on top of that before I will pay my $100 or...
Right.
Or whatever.
And then when you bring up the concept of free, there's free as in it's no cost to me, because it's such a common idea that everybody has implemented it now. And, you know, when I went to university, syntax highlighting was a big deal. It was the sort of thing we studied. And now, you know, syntax highlighting, 12-year-olds do that, you know, on their, in their spare time. Right. And so, but then there's also the concept of free as in free choice. And one of the things that Eclipse does, which I think is really remarkable, is it allows you to choose whether you want to pay for something or not pay for something. So let me give you the example of support. There are companies in the Eclipse ecosystem that will, you can pay them to support Eclipse for you. Or if you choose not to buy support, you could fix the bugs yourself because all of the source code is available. Or if you choose not to do that, you could submit bugs through Bugzilla to Eclipse and hope the people in the projects fix them. So you can choose time, waiting for people to fix them. Mm-hmm. You can choose doing it yourself, or you can choose money where you pay someone to do it. Right? And so you have the opportunity to choose which way that's going to be. And I think that's one of the real powers of open source, is that it gives you that choice to how to spend your time and money. It doesn't force you into a particular vendor's model of, well, you have to pay for support, or you have to wait 2 years for the next version, or whatever it is.
I think that that's about the best definition of the essence of what open source means that I've heard in a long time. I mean, that really resonates with me. I think that the perspective that it should be free and that the committers should jump on every support thing while they're working on the next version is, you know, is an unreasonable expectation, that it appears that some proponents of open source seem to have that kind of an opinion.
Right. And we at Eclipse definitely don't. We acknowledge that each one of our member companies supplies people to work on the various projects. And typically those people who work on the projects have a belief in open source, so they wouldn't be working on it. But at the same time, they work for some corporation that has particular goals in mind about where the next generation of modeling tools should go, for instance. And so if your needs correspond to their needs and their belief in the system, then you're in great shape. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, you have the opportunity to choose some other path while staying with the Eclipse Foundation. You can either make a new plugin, you can modify the plugin, you could, you know, join the project yourself and help guide it. You could.
As a person who's worked for Microsoft for just about 2 months now, it's interesting to watch some of the discussions internally, because some of the younger people, and younger's in kind of air quotes, people who haven't been at Microsoft for 15, 20 years, in different meetings, at every opportunity, someone says, well, how can we get that source out? Which is really unexpected. I did not expect to be in these meetings where someone would say, we're going to write XYZ and we got to figure out some way to get source out. And it turns out that the things that are preventing us from doing that are all of the infrastructure and the legal and the this and the that and the 20 years of Microsoftness working against it. You know, they just released the .NET framework as a reference license, and apparently it took like 2 years of legal wrangling to okay that. And I wanted to get just a little widget. It's just a little scroll bar benefit, a little add-in that a guy at Microsoft's working on released. And I've been there on and off working on this for 2 months to get this silly little DLL with a silly little feature out. And it's been release meetings and legal review and writing EULAs and back and forth. But the fact that people at Microsoft are willing to work for that, I think will move Microsoft hopefully more towards a company that looks like some of these member companies that you're describing.
Yeah. And I think a key thing there that, I think that developers who just walk into this without thinking about the deeper issues don't realize is that we still all need to, we need to make money in somehow in the end. You need to be paid. I need to be paid. The price of gas is going up. I need to be paid more. So there needs to be some model where even if we're making something open, there's still a way for revenue to flow in one way or another. And different companies have chosen different models around that, around open source. But just giving everything away for no cost is not going to work, right? And there are many good reasons to make your software open source. And obviously, since I work for an open source foundation, I believe in them. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe in giving everything away. And I was just giving a talk last week to another company, and I was saying, well, one thing you don't want to give away is your core competency. You know, the thing that's the driving factor that makes all the money for your company. You don't want to give that away. I worked for a company for a while that contracted with a large shipping container firm. And their core competency is scheduling shipping containers to minimize inventory in warehouses. It's a really interesting problem. Mm-hmm. But basically, the inventory of their customers floats around the ocean in these shipping containers and can arrive at destinations at the right time. That algorithm is where they make all their money. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is not actually interesting. But there's no way that they would ship that algorithm out as open source, because then their competitors could all have that exact same algorithm.
Exactly, right? Exactly. That's the algorithm that the chief architect has in a plaque with a patent underneath it hanging above his desk.
Right, and it's handcuffed to it.
But
right.
Maybe 25 years from now, when 12-year-olds start scheduling shipping containers, then there's a new problem that we want to crack, and that does get open sourced.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to take a little bit of a 90-degree left turn, because whenever I get the opportunity to talk to someone who's been in the industry for decades, plural, like yourself, who has not only a lot of experience, but also an advanced degree in these kinds of things, I'm interested in your perspective on where you think language is going. Because as a person who has a computer science background, but not an advanced degree, I'm always interested in some of the language innovations, like around, you know, C# adding Link and Visual Basic adding XML, some of the arguments that are happening between the Java purists and the Java pragmatists as languages that are being developed. And you've gone to Uppsala many times. Do you think that we're breaking some rules? Are there absolute rules, like the kind of the Boochian rules that shouldn't be touched? Or is it okay that we're changing these languages in ways that aren't, you know, pure in the kind of 80s OO kind of sense of the word?
The interesting thing is I am both a pragmatist and a purist in this, in an interesting combination. I think that languages should provide us with the pragmatic bits to allow us to express our algorithms as quickly and as succinctly as possible. I program in Java a lot because Eclipse is written in Java, and I find it at times frustrating in how verbose I have to be to do what appear to be simple things. The language shouldn't be doing that to me. It should make it as easy as possible to do things. I think Link is great because it makes it so that I don't have to write a lot of verbosity to get the simple concepts that I want in terms of database queries. I think the Visual Basic XML syntax also. I mean, if you've ever tried to do XML processing in Java, it's just a nightmare, right? I do a lot of XML processing in PHP these days because there's simple XML and you just use it as a data structure.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly what I want to do, right? At the same time, I find that a lot of the new language designs are not paying attention to some of the really great work that was done even before I was around in university, having to do with closures and full objects that way. Mm-hmm. And so they're reinventing things in sort of badly. And that bothers me because I think, you know, some of those concepts, like languages without closures in the 2000s is just a mistake. I mean, why would you invent a new language that didn't have closures today? Everybody knows how to implement them. Everybody knows how useful they are. And that just boggles my mind. I'm sort of speechless.
Let's not assume that every listener knows what a closure is. Maybe you could just very briefly.
Right. So what's the quick definition of a closure? A closure is a function without a name that I can pass around as a first class object. Mm-hmm. So I can make a function and I can pass it to you and then you can call that function.
Right.
Right. So I think that, you know, the modern languages that are doing things like adding SQL and XML and making it easier and easier for us to write. I was looking at a demonstration of the Adobe Flex stuff last spring, and they've done some amazing things with how to call web APIs without having to do a lot of mechanism around it.
Yeah.
It's just built into the language is how you do that. That's great. We should have more of that. But while we do that, we should also use some of these fundamental concepts that were invented back before they were really able to be implemented well, right? And then I think that language design typically says, well, I have this existing language and then I'm going to incrementally make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who do that don't go back and go, well, I'm going to make it better, but I want to use all the power I've got now. If we look at computers today, disk space is free. I mean, we're recording this podcast onto a disk, I assume.
Yeah.
Or maybe even in memory, because memory is free, right?
It's actually a 2 gig flash card.
Two gig flash card.
$14.
Right. You know, when I first started writing programs, memory was fabulously expensive. And so you had to be very careful how you wrote your algorithms. And so things like closures in languages didn't make a lot of sense because we didn't have the raw CPU horsepower or the memory to spend on those data structures.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that now. So rather than having you or I do essentially in our heads what the computer could do, we should have the computer be doing that work for us and allow us to write the simplest, clearest statement of our algorithms that we're looking for.
I've had some really interesting discussions with some people internally at Microsoft, and we did a podcast on this concept of parallel link, which is going to be basically link with an extra keyword that will recognize how many cores you have on your machine and then scale appropriately. So if you had a for loop, you know, you're going to for each over a million things and you have four cores, it'll automatically handle all the threading, the parallel execution and the coming back together of all that kind of stuff. And it seems like all of us, Microsoft included, kind of the languages are playing catch up a little bit because no one ever expected. I mean, 3 years ago, I would never have said that I would be running a quad core machine. And now they're saying 16 core. Within a year?
Right. And, you know, it used to be you'd have to write Fortran and then you'd have to manually unroll all the loops based on the number of levels of parallelism you had.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, if you were programming a Cray, you unrolled the loop in one way. And if you were programming on a different version of a Cray, an XMP instead of a YMP, you'd unroll it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can basically almost do that in hardware. Now you're talking about doing that in the interpreter or the compiler, but you know, some of these modern Pentium chips almost do that unrolling in the hardware itself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's great because it removes that level of thinking that I have to do as a programmer. Now I still have to, as a programmer, write my for loops in a way that doesn't create cross iteration dependencies, right? Because otherwise it won't unroll properly.
Right.
Right. And the same thing, you know, when I'm writing a really high performance piece of code, I need to think about how the cache lines in the processor work. Because if I access my array in the wrong order, I can actually cause it to do a cache miss on every access.
Right.
Whereas if I rewrite it slightly differently, I can cause it to do a cache hit on every access. Right. And that can affect the speed of my program dramatically. Right?
But that's exactly stuff we shouldn't have to think about. It seems like the language should, I should be able to express my intent in a non, you know, in a dry, in a way that it's not causing myself to repeat myself, like I just did, and in a simple mechanism that will be optimized for whatever environment I've got. If I have a low memory environment, it should be optimized. It should automatically optimize. I feel like just the fact that someone could be writing in a language and then think about what's going on in the processor cache. It's just kind of an uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have a foot in each world.
I can imagine that, you know, that's our goal, to eventually have that work that way. It's been my experience over a couple decades of doing this that, well, we continue to get better abstractions and we can require less thinking of those details. In the end, to get the maximum efficiency, you always have to think about those details.
Yeah.
The exact details that we have to think about change. But, you know, even today when we're thinking about having, say, wide area storage networks where, you know, I'm using Google or Amazon S3 for my storage instead of my local disk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great because it removes a certain level of needing to do backups. For instance, Amazon, some guy runs all the backups for me, I mm-hmm. guess.
Yeah. And they're up in the cloud.
And they're up in the cloud. But on the other hand, it takes more time to get to that for every access than it does to get to my local disk for every access.
Because if it didn't, you'd use it as primary storage.
If I didn't, I'd use it as primary storage.
Yeah.
Plus, the sheer speed of electrons is going to prevent me from having, you know, on your laptop here, the distance between the memory and the CPU is only a couple inches. The difference between, even if there was a direct wire between here and Seattle, the electrons aren't going to travel that fast, right? I mean, there's, after a while, you approach physical limits. So I'm just saying that I think you're always going to have to consider some constraint when you're writing code. It's just we'd like to think of fewer and fewer of them.
Although I didn't expect myself to be writing C# and thinking about, darn, that speed of light limitation, you know. If we could just get around C, then maybe I could get some work done.
Yeah, although I think that for a majority of your programs, you don't have to think about that, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, the smallest, lowest power things you can work on.
Yeah.
I worked for a while for a chip startup company that was building chips for cell phones. And there, it was really important to optimize the programs to use the lowest possible power because the battery only has 800 milliamp hours in it, right? And so it wasn't so much speed as we were programmed for, it was reduced power consumption. And so we would know how much power every instruction would take, and our compiler would tell us every function how much power that function would take. And, you know, because that was the constraint when running inside a cell phone.
I heard that the Linux guys right now are deeply involved in a kind of a system-wide power kind of an audit. And they have an application now that will basically look at a program and give you an idea of how friendly that program is. For example, I guess they discovered that the volume slider was polling in like a really, really tight loop. So when you were changing the volume, your power consumption went way, way up. So they're doing some kind of a system-wide thing to look at all the different applications so that an application could be labeled green or not green. And one could say that when doing a system-wide audit that we've raised the, you know, power, lowered the power consumption by 20% through good programming practices. So then power has become yet another thing to optimize for.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I find that to be pretty crazy. My last question for you back on Eclipse before we go is that have you heard any demand for .NET on Eclipse or C# on Eclipse? Are there any projects that are involved or any member companies that are interested in providing a .NET environment such that I could be using Eclipse for my .NET work?
So far there's no member company I know of that's providing a C# environment. But the people who work on the C++ tooling mm-hmm. have made a prototype of a C# tooling.
Mm.
And they actually have it and it's working and they've actually written some programs on top of it. So far there's not a lot of demand for C# on Eclipse because there's great C# tools out of the Microsoft environment.
Sure.
Right. But, it's definitely been proven to work and you can, you know, write your programs and run them and debug them and, you know, the whole thing.
Well, I've definitely found the Aptana application to be a good complement to Visual Studio. Even though the new version of Visual Studio has JavaScript debugging, one of the things I thought was amazing about Aptana is that they'll be able to tell you in JavaScript, HTML, or CSS which browsers will be supported on for that particular thing. So if you're using some feature, it has a beautiful IntelliSense that has a column with a grayed out or not grayed out icon of the browser that you're about to use. And you say, well, look, this won't work in Opera, but it will work in this and it will work in that.
Yeah,
it's a gorgeous IDE.
The Aptama guys are really sharp. And I think that's an example of where they've chosen to make the right level of abstraction to solve your problems so that you don't have to think about them. You know, if you look at a more traditional JavaScript editor, it just edits JavaScript and maybe it does syntax highlighting and IntelliSense and so on, but it's just sort of a pure JavaScript editor. It doesn't go further and say, well, you know, if you're editing JavaScript that uses the Dojo framework, what else do you want to know, right? What are the little idioms that you would use when doing that? And the Aptama guys have gone a little bit farther and done that bit of it, right?
Well, I think that's a really great example of what can be done on Eclipse, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we will see you again next week.